Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. Today is Monday, September 17th. On today's show, we have Diane Randall. Diane is the Executive Secretary of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. That is the Quaker Lobbying Group. That is the largest peace activist lobbying group on Capitol Hill. They lobby, obviously, against war. They have a wonderful location on Capitol Hill. They are located right across the street from the Senate Hart Building and just down the street from the Supreme Court, where when we interviewed Diane a couple of weeks ago, phase one of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings were taking place. And as of today, it looks like there may be another round of hearings coming up. Diane was a great interview, and she hails from Nebraska. She's a Cornhusker. She started off as a teacher. From there, she got involved in the Omaha Nuclear Freeze campaign, and eventually she made her way to Connecticut. Her family moved here, and she raised her family here, and she was elected to the school board in Connecticut, and also worked in housing issues in a group in Connecticut that was funded by the Melville Trust. She was also a state lobbyist, a white hat lobbyist here in Connecticut on housing and other issues. And she went from being a state lobbyist to running a major federal office down on Capitol Hill in Washington. And it's a very interesting organization. It's 75 years old. It's the first faith-based organization of its type. And we just had a great chat. We talked about they're working on in favor of nuclear disarmament. They're working on the AUMF, which is the authorization for use of military force. They're trying to limit the use of that legislation, and working with Senator Murphy's office in regards to Turkey and that issue. And so we just had a great chat. I think you'll find Diane very interesting. And they, as a group, are very well organized, and they have many different types of internships. They have a spring lobbying day for college students in March, where college students come down for 3 days and learn about lobbying and learn about working on Capitol Hill. They also have a year-long program that's for post-college grads. And all this information, they also have summer internships, and all this information about internships is on their website. So if you are interested in that, I would encourage you to check out their website. So I hope you enjoy the interview with Diane Randall. We enjoyed sitting down with her. So I'm here with Diane Randall at FCNL, which is the Friends Committee
on National Legislation.
Mm-hmm. So Diane, what's your connection to FCNL?
Sure. Well, I am my actual title is Executive Secretary, and the reason I have that title is because it's a Quaker title. This is a Quaker organization, and it's the equivalent to being the Executive Director.
Okay.
And I came to the Friends Committee on National Legislation because they were looking for a new head of the organization back in 2010. And I am a Quaker, and that was important for them to have a Quaker to be the head of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. And because I had experience lobbying, in Connecticut, and this is a lobbying organization that works on national legislation. So we work specifically with Congress.
Right, and your mission is peace-oriented.
It's very peace-oriented, and so our mission really is, we have a very big vision, and it is very idealistic, and that is a world free of war and the threat of war, a society with equity and justice for all, mm-hmm. a community where every person's potential may be fulfilled, and an earth restored. So that kind of covers a very wide range of social justice issues, all the way from peace issues and to include issues around racial justice and economic justice, but it also includes issues related to environmental stewardship and renewable energy.
And what are some of the primary issues you're working on right now?
Sure. So we work on nuclear disarmament. Okay. We work on promoting diplomacy. So an example of something we did work on was the Iran deal, the JCPOA deal with to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. And so when that deal was scuttled by the president, we were disappointed. Right now, we're also working on, we actually do support this president's efforts to try to have diplomacy with North Korea, because we think that diplomacy is a much better alternative to war. And so we promote these initiatives that are focusing on diplomacy. We also believe that this country has become kind of slid into wars and into military engagement in ways that aren't healthy and aren't correct and don't follow the Constitution. So we also lobby on the authorization for the use of military force, the so-called AUMF, authorization for the use of military force. So we believe that it's important for Congress to take back their constitutional duty of declaring war. And so any initiatives that would lead the United States into engage in military conflict, we believe must be debated by Congress. And so we are working on specific bills that have been put forward. For example, Senator Murphy of Connecticut has a bill that is trying to say that no funds could be authorized for a war with North Korea. And we have folks who are lobbying on that. So that's on the, let me just say, that's on the war issue, mm-hmm. but there are issues like, for example, we also lobby on immigration, and so we're lobbying for a compassionate and comprehensive immigration reform. What that looks like most immediately is that we're lobbying against a lot more money going into detention and deportation.
Okay.
So,
and what are you lobbying for? Do you
in terms of immigration
on that issue?
We were lobbying for the DREAM Act, which we don't think is going to move right now, but at basically trying to create a sort of a resolution for dreamers and their families, the so-called. So we also follow what happens in the courts, but we're not doing any direct. We don't do any work. We don't do litigation work or directly involve ourselves. But there's kind of a stay right now for DACA recipients, and so we're very supportive of that.
Okay, and are you doing anything currently with the Iran issue?
Well, we're monitoring it right now because our focus as a lobbying organization, we really focus on Congress, and there's not a lot of opportunity right now in Congress on that because it was an agreement, a diplomatic agreement between the United States and six other countries. And so we're very concerned about the abrogation of or stepping away of that, you know, from that treaty, just as we're concerned about stepping away from the Paris Climate Agreement. These were sort of long belabored diplomatic agreements at the highest levels of our
country. In the last administration.
In the last administration, right. And so there are some things that while we do some work with federal agencies, most of the work that we do here in Washington is with Congress. And so sometimes we might be encouraging Congress to speak out on a particular issue, but there's not a lot of legislation pending.
Okay. And when was the last time that Congress declared war? Since 9/11, it seems like we've had a lot of slippery...
So in 2001, there was an authorization for the use of military force, which was a very broadly worded statement that basically was the has been the impetus for the U.S.
Since then.
Involvement in Iraq and in Afghanistan and pretty much everywhere. And it's been used to sort of really fight the war on terror as it's been defined. So any of our military engagement with Al-Qaeda and ISIS and virtually all of it is predicated on that 2001 authorization for the use of military force.
Okay. And Senator Murphy is trying to say that when it comes to North Korea, you really need congressional approval prior to you.
For the appropriation. And Senator Murphy's been a real leader on trying to kind of, I think, rethink foreign policy for the United States in the era that we're in. And so we've appreciated his leadership on that.
Now,
So for the young people listening, so you're interacting a lot with Congress.
Right.
So like pick an issue that you've worked on. Are you talking a lot to the staff? How
yes.
often are you meeting with the congressional people? Like, what is that?
Yeah.
Do you use grassroots? You obviously
yeah.
have supporters across the country.
Yes. All that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So just a little bit about this organization. So the Friends Committee on National Legislation is actually 75 years old. We are the first faith-based lobby, and so faith-based meaning our Quakerism as a faith. And so we
tell our listeners about, for those who don't know.
Quakers. So Quakers are a historic peace church, and it's a Christian-based religion that basically, as practiced in the United States, has a couple different ways, but it really does focus on encouraging people to let their lives speak, so to speak, you know, so that it's not, you know, like if you are practicing this faith, you should be like practicing it every day, not just when you go to church. And so that means that if you believe in the, you know, a gospel of, you know, the gospel, which is, you know, stating how we might live, you're going to live in a more peaceful way, and you're going to try to work to find equality for everyone.
Not just on Sunday.
Exactly.
Or whatever. Maybe.
And so that's why there's a lot of people who get involved in various movements. So Quakers historically worked for the abolition of slavery. They've worked for suffrage for women. They've worked against war. And so throughout sort of the last, really throughout U.S. history, Quakers have been involved in a lot of social justice movements. We are very small. There aren't a lot of Quakers around the country. And so it's sort of unusual for us to have a fairly robust lobbying organization for such a small denomination. But because social justice has long been important, this organization was actually established during World War II in 1943 in Richmond, Indiana.
Okay.
A lot of Quakers in Indiana, a lot of Quakers in North Carolina, Pennsylvania. But we do work with people, in addition to working with Quakers, we work with anyone who wants to be involved on the issues we work on. Exactly.
Right.
So you don't have to be a Quaker at all.
Right.
it's just that our priorities, our legislative priorities, are established by actually a very democratic process in terms of Quakerism. We go out to the Quakers around the country and say, what do you think we should be working on? And we do that every 2 years, every Congress.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So it's not dictated from a...
There's not that hierarchy.
Not a hierarchy. Oh, very interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And so there's a fair amount of consistency. It changes a little bit every year what we work on. But the organization right now, we have a pretty big staff. We have a staff of 50 here in Washington.
Wow.
And that's
what's your annual budget?
About $7 million.
Okay.
So
you have a great location right here down the street from the Supreme Court.
Exactly. We're across the street from the Hart Senate Office Building, so it's prime location.
Yes.
We have about 20 lobbyists, and we have a fundraising staff. We have a field staff.
The 20 lobbyists, sorry to interrupt you, on staff or outside?
On staff.
On staff, okay.
So everybody's on staff.
Yep.
So we basically run programs through our staff, and then we have a whole bunch of volunteers all around the country, grassroots
okay.
folks.
Okay.
We also are cultivating what we call a grass tops program, basically people who may have relationships with members of Congress or their staffs already and can help us, you know, have access. And really, our main theory of change is we want to influence Congress. And
right.
we do that by the work that we do ourselves. We do it by working in coalition with other NGOs, non-governmental organizations, or other faith-based organizations.
Yep.
But we also do it by engaging people, constituents of those members. And so we've found that, you know, we don't... Sorry, let me just say the thing about us. We have both a 501c3 and a 501c4 organization. And it's the C4 organization which essentially would allows us to lobby without having to put a lot of restrictions on what we do.
Right, okay.
We are completely nonpartisan. So we never use our C4 for endorsing candidates. We don't work for candidates.
Okay.
We encourage people to go get involved in elections. We think it's really important that people know their local candidates and what they're doing, both for local office as well as for federal office. But we have a pretty robust communication system where we ask people to lobby by email. But we've also set up structures at the local level for people to build relationships with their members of Congress.
Okay.
And that relationship building is also a really key aspect of how we think lobbying can be effective.
Would you say it's maybe the most important?
Yes.
Yes.
Would you say that too, Jeff?
I would.
Yeah.
I would.
Yeah.
You know, they hear from professionals all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say they get sick of seeing us, but they're like, okay, you know. But if they hear from a constituent who cares
And who has and who tells their own story.
Right. In their own way.
Exactly.
Right.
It makes a huge difference.
Right.
And you know, when I used to lobby in Connecticut, which is where we met.
Yes.
And I saw that happen at the state legislature, but I've also seen it happen here in Washington, D.C. at the congressional level, is that members really do want to hear about from their people in their districts. And
right.
that doesn't mean they're going to do everything the member asks or the constituent asks them to, but it is important for them to know what's going on. And, you know, for most members of Congress, and I think for a lot of elected officials, time is like the hardest, you know, that's like the least thing they have the least of in terms of being able to talk
right.
to people. And so
right.
When you actually do get time to go and, you know, have it be able to share a story or talk to a member about an issue, it usually has an impact on them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what's something you're spending a lot of time lobbying on right now?
Well, we have like about 10 different priorities that we work on. So,
okay.
for example, on economic justice, we're really concerned about the Farm Bill and specifically about the title that deals with the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the
yep.
so-called SNAP program,
okay.
which used to be called food stamps. The House actually put through a provision that would require a lot of new changes that states could make that would require much more of a limitations on the program and require people to have to work. A lot of people who get SNAP already are working, but it would put a lot of provisions on this program that could also have detrimental impact on people with disabilities and on families with children. And so we did not like the House side. The,
mm-hmm.
the Senate passed a separate version of the Farm Bill
mm-hmm.
that was much better on the supplemental, on SNAP program. So
okay.
right now, back this week, the conferees are going to be getting together on that. And so we're trying to push for the Senate version to be adopted.
Okay. And so you're reaching out to the members on both of those committees.
Both those committees, and specifically, and this is a case where we're working with a lot of other faith-based
groups.
Organizations
okay.
and a lot of other human service organizations. So,
yeah.
But one of the things that we each try to bring to it is to say, who do we do a lot of analysis about who do we think are members who we think we can have the most influence with, you know,
mm-hmm.
in most cases, in most lobbying situations, you kind of know where a lot of members are going to stand. And then there's always that group in the middle where you're not quite sure where they're going to be.
Right.
So we identify swings on this and we
yeah.
figure out like, well, if the swings are in Minnesota and North Dakota, who do we have in those states? That meaning who's our constituency that are part of FCNL or that are part of, if we're working with the Catholic Conference of Bishops, or if we're working
yep.
with the Lutherans, who do they have that might be willing to speak out on these issues?
Okay.
And so that's the kind of work that we do, is trying to like think through, you know, what's the big legislative ask? How do you get constituents involved? And how do we do the analysis, sort of the power analysis of both who we have that has some influence there, but also who's going to be a big swing on any particular issue.
Right.
So we're working on that. We're working on still this issue around North Korea is a very big issue for us.
Yep.
We think it's a sort of a long-term focus that there's a real opportunity here for peace between South Korea and North Korea, between, you know, North Korea and the rest of the world, but it is not going to happen fast. You know, diplomacy takes a long time. So part of what our work is education and working with members of Congress to get them to promote diplomacy and understand that this is a long-term commitment that they need to be behind as well. We also working, one of the really exciting pieces of work that we're doing on climate change has been to work with something called the Climate Solutions Caucus.
Okay.
This is a bipartisan caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives that has agreed that climate change is real, that it's caused by humans, and that there are solutions that we can take to address it. Now, that seems, on the one hand, if you're a person who like has paid a lot of attention to climate change, that may seem like not very much. If you're a person who doesn't think climate change is really a problem caused by humans, that may feel like too far. And so this truly is this bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus that is also so-called Noah's Ark Caucus, because it has to have, for every Democrat that joins, it has to have a Republican.
Okay.
So there, it's now up to 84 members.
Wow.
Yep, 42 Republicans.
That's impressive.
42, yep. We've been doing this with some other, so Citizens for Climate Lobby is one of the organizations we work with. But our staff person has really cultivated some really strong relationships with the staff of key members. In particular, Representative Curbelo, a Republican from Miami, a city that is very, very affected by climate change in terms of sea level rise, has provided a great deal of leadership. And Representative Curbelo has actually just introduced a carbon tax bill, first significant piece of legislation introduced by a Republican in a long time. So, again, our work is kind of both, you know, providing advice to staff, but also trying to convene people and then to continue to work with this caucus to promote. The particular piece of legislation that I just talked about was introduced by, is not a caucus position, but it opens up a conversation for the caucus to happen.
Well, and the and creating, helping bring the, create that climate caucus is really...
It's big.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's particularly in this environment, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's ingenious. And 84 members.
Yeah.
That's...
It's really grown a lot. I mean, it started a few years back with just a few members, and there have been a variety of people that have, we really, when we started looking at it, we were talking to people after Hurricane Sandy, where whose districts had really been hit hard, as well as districts in the Midwest that have been hit by drought. And now we see, you know, members who represent districts with wildfires, you know, and so all of these kind of dramatic crises, in a sense, have driven us to think about what is it that we might do. And so clearly there's a lot of support in Congress that's bipartisan for addressing mitigation. But the bigger issues of, like, are there, in addition to mitigating and trying to, like, you know, build more seawalls or address, you know, what is the inevitable sea rise, are there ways that we can actually look at really the reduction of carbon in our environment in a more meaningful way? And so our position is that, you know, a price on carbon is one of those, but we have, you know, so that dialogue we think is ripe right now, but it will take some leadership from Congress to really move it along.
Right. And that's just on the House side?
That's only on the House side.
Have you thought about the Senate side?
We have, and there certainly are people on the Senate side who are more on the Democrat side than they're on the Republican side right now, but there are some. I think that, you know, one of the challenges is that there's just legislation moves so slowly in Congress. When I worked at the State House in Connecticut, I thought things were slow there, but coming to Washington and lobbying here, it's very slow, right?
Really,
really slow until it's fast, and then it happens really fast.
Then it happens overnight.
Yeah.
And so, getting back to the farm bill, is it hard to get the House members to support the Senate version, or what's the for those of the listening who don't lobby on the federal level?
Yeah.
What's the nuance or the difficulty in what you're trying to do there?
Well, clearly, you know, on the federal level, leadership play. I mean, as in any, I think both at the state level too, leadership plays a really key role. And so, and I think the changes that are happening right now in the House with Paul Ryan leaving are kind of opening up questions and sort of seeing what will happen. And then, of course, the other dynamic on the House side is, you know, you have some pretty strong caucuses like the Freedom Caucus, the basically Libertarian Caucus, you know, makes it hard for movement to happen. I actually don't know sort of most like the day-to-day update about what's been happening on the House side in terms of whether the Ag Committee is actually moving at all on this and sort of where that goes. But that's what the conference will be about, to see where we go with that.
Okay. Wow. All right. So can we actually go back and talk about you, for instance?
Sure.
I think I said University of Nebraska.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes. I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska.
So you grew up in Omaha and obviously went to the University of Nebraska.
Yes.
What was your major?
My major was actually education. I was a teacher first. That was my first job. I taught high school English.
Oh, wow. For how long?
For 4 years.
How was that?
It was a really hard job.
Was it?
Teaching's a hard job. But I loved it. I love working with young people because they are, like, so inquisitive and curious. And I like teaching English. So I did that. I taught English in a suburban town outside of Omaha.
Okay.
And then I left because I had a child, and it was the time, it was in the 80s, and the nuclear freeze campaign was this kind of movement happening to try to address the issue of nuclear weapons. And I was not political. I mean, I really just like came into this because I thought, it is so amazing that we have all these nuclear weapons that we could kill each other multiple times over. I had just become a mom, and I was really motivated from a very personal way of saying, what can I as a citizen do? And this movement felt like something where I could get involved and, you know, talk to my members of Congress and try to get the Nebraska, of course, has a unicameral. I heard someone talking about that on a previous podcast. Yes. We tried to get a resolution passed through the unicameral and around the nuclear freeze campaign. So that was my first and early engagement in politics. And it was really coming at it from a citizen advocate kind of point of view.
Okay.
Yeah. So I left teaching. I actually worked for the Omaha Nuclear Freeze campaign, doing education and advocacy work. And then I moved to Connecticut in the mid-80s. And when I first got there, I was trying to figure out what to do. I made a connection with a group that was working to abolish the death penalty. Well, they were actually working, I don't know that they had an abolition position, but they were working to try to prevent the death penalty from being expanded in Connecticut in the 80s. And it was a great coalition of people. It included folks from the Public Defender's Office. It included folks from the Catholic Church, it included Quakers, and a broad group of organizations. And so I worked very, very part-time on that. And the person I connected with who really was my mentor and got me into lobbying was a woman named Pat Wallace, who worked for the Archdiocese of Hartford. They had an Office of Urban Affairs, which was doing advocacy for the poor. And Pat asked me to come in and work with her when she went on a maternity leave. And I guess I would just say for the young people who may be listening to this, I said it's sometimes saying yes to something that you really don't even know what you're getting into. And so I said yes, and I really didn't know very much about the Connecticut General Assembly. So my earliest work was monitoring bills and trying to figure out what was happening without really having a lot of background in state politics or in Connecticut politics at all. But I had a lot of people who were willing to kind of like give me guidance and hold my hand and, you know, tell me which committee room to go into and what the next step was that the committee was going to take.
Yep.
And Pat was really a mentor to me. And so it was through that work that I started getting involved in doing some work on affordable housing, because that was one of the issues they worked on. And that then led to working on the issue of housing for people with HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm. And I worked with a group called the Connecticut AIDS Residents Coalition, which is now part of a broader group called the Connecticut AIDS Coalition.
Yeah.
And then I went from that to work with Betty Gallo, who is a lobbyist many people know, recently retired lobbyist, lobbied for a long time in Connecticut on many issues, working on housing. And from that, we kind of spun off and created an organization called the Partnership for Strong Communities.
Yes. And tell people about that. That is...
It's a fantastic organization.
It's quite the organization.
Yeah. That's grown, that's done amazing work since I left, but we
and,
were...
And had and funding from the Melville Trust, is that...
Correct, yeah. So the Melville Charitable Trust was a family foundation that had determined that they would focus on addressing the root causes of homelessness to prevent and end homelessness. And so they funded work to help build up governmental support for addressing that, as well as to build capacity among organizations to address it. They really came at this issue of saying shelters, emergency shelters, the street is not addressing homelessness, that you really have to have a system that prevents people from getting homeless, but also then creates housing options, even for people who may have mental illness or substance abuse problems. And so we lobbied to get more funding, and we saw some successes through a number of administrations.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Governor Malloy came in, he was a real champion, and the partnership, I think this was after my time there, but has done an amazing work in, with the, this administration, getting a fairly significant investment in affordable and supportive housing. So we worked, so Mike Hanley, who some of the people you know came to work
Dan
with us.
Dan Fink and some others.
Some folks who
They had some great success.
Yeah.
I mean,
great people.
And so you worked there till 2011?
Correct.
When you came here?
That's right.
Wow, okay. And you moved to Washington, D.C.?
Moved the family to Washington, D.C. My husband was writing for the Hartford Courant. He left his job at the Hartford Courant and came down here and has been doing freelance work. We pulled our youngest child out of the middle of her high school years to move here, and that was a big challenge, but she made it. has now graduated from college even, so that's all good.
So it worked out.
That was a big change to move to Washington, and it was exciting.
Has it been a great change? Has it been?
It has been. I really, this is a great city to live in, and it's a young city. There are a lot of young people. Yeah. That, you know, we have a lot of young people who work here at FCNL. I would say that of the 50 people who work here, I'd say probably about 2/3 of them are under 30.
Okay.
Partly because we have a program where we have like 10 people come and spend a year with us,
okay,
kind of as an apprentice, like on a particular program, learning about it. But even when you walk around Washington, D.C., you know, you see a lot of young people here, and there's if you care about politics and policy, it's a great place to be.
Right.
It's a really great place to be. But it's also intense. I mean, there's just, you feel the politics all the time.
And do you have to do, is there a lot of work at night, you know?
So my role as the head of the organization actually has me out on the road a fair amount. So I do some of the fundraising.
Okay.
And so I'm going out to speak to groups, a lot of Quaker groups, but also a few others, but also to do fundraising, meeting with some of our major donors and just kind of visibility that way. I don't do as many like receptions or dinners, and I do some of that, and we do some of that. The other staff do it, but we also are doing a lot of the work. You had asked early on, sort of what our lobbyists, how they work. They do a lot of work with staff of the congressional offices.
Okay.
So it's more likely like our lobbyist who works on Middle East policy. This is one of the issues we're working on a lot right now. Is this issue of the U.S. involvement in Yemen, in the war that Saudi Arabia is perpetrating on Yemen. We're really concerned because U.S. warplanes are refueling Saudi jets and causing really significant and severe humanitarian crisis for both civilians and for all of Yemen. And so our lobbyist on that issue has been working with other staffers in key offices to try to move legislation forward that would put limits on United States involvement in that. So that's a very live issue right now. So you asked about that. So a lot of that is done by meetings on the Hill, but it's also done by a lot of email, a lot of conversations. Sometimes, you know, a whole group will go in to meet. Sometimes it's one-on-one.
Okay.
So the daily work of a lobbyist here would be sometime on the Hill and sometime in offices, sometimes going to coalition meetings, a lot of preparation of sort of like staying really current on the issue, participating in listservs and participating in, you know, dialogues about this, and then just building relationships with staffers that, you know, provides intelligence and kind of like, you know, on how to move forward.
Right. Do you have internships here?
Yeah, we do. We have some great programs for young people. So we have summer internships that actually pay. I'm really proud of the fact that we pay our interns.
Jeez.
We give them a stipend that allows them at least to cover their housing costs because D.C. is not an inexpensive place to live.
No. My daughter was here this summer.
Okay. You know.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's like a mortgage.
We do an 8-week internship in the summer. And then this program that I was referring to where we have people come and spend 11 months with us, we call it a Young Fellows Program. And so the application actually opens – the application probably opens in November, and the applications are due in February. And it's a competitive program. And people come, it's for recent college graduates, for the most part is who we get. Sometimes we get people who've been out of school for a little bit. But they apply, and then we go through a whole interview process and a selection process. They come and work full-time with us. And they get paid, they don't get paid well, but they do get paid decent. We pay full benefits for our young fellows.
Okay.
And they stay with us from essentially beginning of September until the end of July.
Okay.
And we do professional development with them, really try to promote networking. They actually do they do lobby trainings for us for constituents who come in. They will be up on the Hill lobbying. They set up lobby visits. They are they really work as staff. It is not a people have remarked to me that we provide the kinds of experiences that a lot of young people don't get in these programs.
So. Yeah, I would say that's some great training.
It's great training.
Really?
Yeah, I'm proud of the people who've worked as they've gone. You know, a lot of people who've worked for us have gone and done pretty remarkable things.
I bet.
Working in congressional offices, providing leadership in other organizations. So not everybody stays in Washington. And what I say to them when they come, you know, I say, look, some people love this work and know that it's meant for them. And other people realize, like, this is not for me, you know? And so when you get that opportunity at age 22 or 23 to figure that out, you should seize it and try it.
Just say yes.
Back just to your say yes.
Right. And then the summer interns, how many do you typically, is there a number?
It varies. It kind of depends on a little bit how much work we have and what specific projects we have for them to do.
Okay.
This past summer, we had 7. We have 10 people in this Young Fellows program. But then the other program that
we have... So that's 17.
That's 17, but that's only the tip of the iceberg because we also have a program called the Advocacy Corps, and this is another program that people apply for. Sometimes people who are already in college, and it is a program that has people coming... They come to Washington for 10 days for something we call the Washington Summer Intensive, and it's not just the heat that's intensive. The program is intensive.
Although it is hot.
It is hot.
Yes.
But they learn organizing skills, they learn about media, they learn about building relationships with members of Congress, and then they go back to their local communities, and they get paid a stipend, a very modest stipend, but they get paid a stipend to actually deliver like a certain number of lobby visits or media hits or, you know, on a particular issue. And we provide support and coaching for them over the course of this year. And one of the things that's exciting about that is that we've really used it as an opportunity to diversify our own network and our own programs, because Quakers are, you know, traditionally a pretty white Protestant group of people, not exclusively, but that we are, you know, sort of come from, that's the orientation. And so we believe it's really an important value for us to have a more ethnically and socioeconomically diverse organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've really... done a lot of work to recruit in both places where there aren't quite as many Quakers. We recruit Quakers. We have Quakers involved, but we've also recruited people from a lot of places and gone to some schools that, like state colleges and actually some community colleges, and found people who are willing and excited to organize and who, if you know, but for kind of someone helping provide support for them to come and do this, might not be involved directly in working in Washington.
Right.
And so that's super exciting. And particularly now, as we see, you know, in this election cycle, we're seeing such dramatic changes in terms of, you know, upsets, you know, just yesterday in Massachusetts, and we've seen it in New York.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're starting at a very younger age, like people in their early 20s that are interested. But I'm excited that we're able to provide those kind of opportunities to people that allow them to get into the offices directly. And time after time, we hear from people, you know, like who are 21 years old, who will say, I had no idea that I could walk into my member's office and have a conversation with a staffer. Yes. I had no idea. And, you know, it is like sort of basic democracy 101.
Yes.
But we don't practice it that much.
No. And we don't teach it, the petitioning. Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah, and there was a, you skipped over, or you served on the school board.
I did.
So was serving on a local board maybe the hardest job you had? Or how long were you on the board?
I only served one term on the West Hartford Board of Education. And I ran at a time that was in 1995, where there was some controversy in the town about redistricting. And that motivated me to run. Because I felt really... distressed by the acrimony in town, and I didn't quite completely understand it. And serving helped me understand a lot more, honestly. I mean, it really opened up my mind to understand a point of view that was different than my own. It didn't necessarily change my mind, but I really began to understand, I think, the motivation of individuals, because I heard people's stories, you know, of why they cared about so deeply about the school, the elementary school their child went to. And, you know, at its essence, you know, politics is about human beings, and it's really about sort of forming, you know, the system that allows us to form a government that functions best for people and for all people, not just for a few, right?
Right.
And so that's really serving in that capacity, running for public office and then getting elected and serving. Yeah, I'm really glad I did it, because I felt like I learned a whole lot.
Yeah.
Had I started... maybe at a younger age, maybe I would have stayed in it and continued running for other things, but I don't have regrets about that. I'm glad I did it, but I don't have any regrets.
So you served one 2-year term?
4-year term.
One 4-year term. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a fair amount of service.
It was a commitment. It was at a time that West Hartford was doing some great things in its schools, and you know, so it was good to be part of that.
And whereabouts do you live down here in Washington?
So when we moved to Washington, D.C., as you noted earlier, this office is right here on Capitol Hill, which is just prime location. And
how long has the office been
here? The office has been here since the 50s. Wow. But here's an interesting story. Before I got here in the early 2000s, this building was literally falling apart. And the organization had to make a decision. Do we sell this property and move into a different space that, mm-hmm. you know, allows us to grow and because we knew we could sell it for something? Or do we take the effort to have a capital campaign to renovate the building? They chose to do that, have a capital campaign to renovate the building. And because of our witness about sustainability, said, we're going to make it a green building, which of course was more expensive, like in the early 2000s. And yep. so this small little three-story building here became the first LEED certified building on Capitol Hill.
Wow.
Not anymore. I mean, there's a lot of LEED certified right. buildings and it's exciting, but that was really exciting. So when I moved here in 2011, I thought I would try to live on Capitol Hill, and we found it hard to find a house that would accommodate, you know, we felt we needed enough space for the family, and yep. They're pretty small townhouses on Capitol Hill and pretty expensive.
Yes.
So we did end up moving to a neighborhood called Mount Pleasant,
okay.
which is kind of by Columbia Heights and Adams Morgan, and it's a great neighborhood. We're really okay. happy there. It involves a commute by metro. So being here on the hill, we don't have parking available, and so we've really kind of stopped. We don't drive very much in our family at all. We pretty much take metro or take buses, and we become yep. walkers. And if people have spent time in Washington, D.C., you know, it's a great biking city as well.
Right.
I'm not riding my bike, but I do recommend it if you're a bike rider.
Maybe waiting for it to get a little cooler.
A little cooler. And honestly, it's I have to say, I'm kind of the age now where I just like, I'm not sure that I want to weave in and out of the traffic the way I see yeah, bicycles it's a doing. Little, yeah.
Well, Diane, this has been great. I really appreciate you taking the time sure. to do this. And
it's exciting you're doing it because I, you know, when I will just say this, but that one of the things that I learned when I was lobbying, I mean, I feel like I've always, my friend, you know, Mike always would talk about, you know, sometimes in Connecticut, they talk about white hat lobbyists,
yes, and black hat lobbyists. Yeah. Yes.
So I've kind of always been in that white hat, you know, yes. I've worked for like, yes. you know, social justice, good guy organizations, but I really do think one thing that's important about lobbying that's certainly true for us here at the Friends Committee on National Legislation is that integrity really matters, you know, and that lawmakers do rely on lobbyists for information
right.
and they rely on them to be honest brokers. And
right.
so, you know, I know that not everyone is, but my aspiration for lobbying is that people really do it with a level of integrity, you know, and I think I feel really honored that I've been able to work for organizations where we've been able to do that. But that's really important for good governance.
Well, and for you, for example, let's say you're going up and you're lobbying, let's say, a Republican member on climate or something where yeah. they're a little skeptical, and you don't give them accurate information. They're never going to trust you again.
That's right.
So it is critically important that the information you give is accurate and you know, and fair and
that's
balanced.
Right. That's right. And it's coming from a point of view, no question about it. That's kind of what an organization's trying to do is influence. But you've got to be able to be fair and understand. And I'd say the other thing that we really try to do is we try to listen. We try to listen to what the staffer says, what the lawmaker says.
What their concerns are.
Exactly.
Because it's not what you think it is.
Exactly.
Sometimes.
Right.
Right.
And you might hear something that allows you to approach the issue in a slightly different way.
Right.
So that listening aspect is a way to build a relationship as well, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, you're, and if, you know, I don't know about you, but I have found that most lobbyists are extremely straightforward and balanced because if they're not, the fallout is just, it's...
It doesn't serve you.
Right. It doesn't serve you well
you
at all.
You can't lose.
So even if you look at it from a selfish perspective,
yeah.
it's in their self-interest to be straightforward and give the balanced view and say, here's what I'm advocating for.
Right.
Here's what the other side may say. Here's the risk for you. Here's the political aspect of it or whatever it may
or
be.
Or opportunity.
Or opportunity, yeah.
yeah. Yeah. And a lot of what we try to do because, I mean, and clearly, you know, a lot of lobbyists do have the capacity to help raise money for members of Congress and they do that or for state house candidates. We're not doing that for members of Congress, but we can find people in their constituency
mm-hmm.
who will give them some political space, so mm-hmm. to speak. You know, so especially if they're taking a position that is difficult for them in terms of their constituency is finding the constituents in that district who do agree with them and who are willing to speak out and who
and
are willing to stand
them.
By them. Yeah.
Right.
That's right.
Well, and in Connecticut now, as you know, we have public financing.
Yes.
So all the money is really out of the campaigns. So, well, Diane, this has been great.
Thank you
very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's really great to connect with you. I love talking about my work, so this is a great opportunity.
Well, I think I'll have to say this is my favorite office location yet. So, all right,
Come
thank
back.
You. I will.
Okay.
So there it is. I hope you enjoyed it. We really enjoyed sitting down with Diane. Great organization, great person, and we appreciate her taking the time. So until next Monday, have a great week. And remember to check us out on Twitter at The Lobbying Show. Check us out on Facebook. Check us out on LinkedIn. And if you haven't already, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes or whatever platform you may be on. And you can also leave us comments. We read all the comments and take them into consideration. Thank you.